Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Jordan with a little big story weekend treat for you. As you might or might not know, at Frequency, we end up involved in a lot of things related to podcast events in Canada. This week in Toronto, one of the good friends of our network, his name is Jeff Merrick. He's the co-host of 31 Thoughts, which is basically the world's best hockey podcast. He got a chance to sit down with a legend in the podcasting business. You may have heard of Dan Carlin, host of Hardcore History. Here at The Big Story, we cover current events. But it's always amazing how often our guests turn to the past for explanations of what's happening now. And that is Carlin's turf. His new book, The End Is Always Near, chronicles apocalyptic moments throughout history, from the Bronze Age to nuclear near misses. Lord knows I get freaked out that the world is about to end every few weeks. And so this discussion was extremely relevant to my interests. And Claire and I thought it might be relevant to yours, too. So we just asked them both if we could run it on our podcast. And Jeff and Dan said yes. So here it is. Enjoy a little extra from us, from 31 Thoughts and from Hardcore History. And if it's not for you, then no worries. We'll be back on Monday with a fresh big story. And we'll talk then.
Thank you.
So the one thing that I do know about you, Dan, is that you don't handle compliments well. But here we are at a near sold-out house. This is a pretty big compliment to Dan Carlin. I know everyone's excited about the book. You should be. I've read it twice. It's fantastic. All hardcore history podcast listeners, common sense as well. How do you react to this?
I'm just glad there's more than two of you here, to be honest. And I might have to take a photo of all of you together to prove to my children that anyone wants to hear me talk about anything. So I really, and you're right, listen, to be honest, as nice as an intro as that was, it's uncomfortable because I just feel like a guy who got really lucky and an audience that really treated me really nicely. And the fact that all of you here are, it is humbling. I appreciate it more than you'll ever know. And I know people say stuff like this and don't really mean it, but you know, I'm not really an emotional kind of guy. It makes me a little teary because I do remember walking out of my financial advisor's office many times and knowing that right behind me, everybody was rolling their eyes at me deciding to try to make a living podcasting. And the worst part was I never knew that they weren't totally right. So I'm so thankful that you're here, and thank you so much for listening to the program and everything. It means a lot to all of everybody in my family, so thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dan Carlin.
Thank you.
We both have a talk radio background, so I'm going to open with a standard device, word association. So here's what's going to happen. First 10 minutes or so, well, we'll see how wordy you are. It might be longer.
Yeah, it might be one.
Might be. We know, and by the way, the new podcast just dropped on Thursday. Thank you. Now we all have to go back and listen to parts one and two before we get to part three of Supernova. So thanks for that, Dan. I'm going to give you a name, an event, a place, a thing, whatever comes to your mind, please share with the audience. It's like playing the hits.
Okay.
I remember going to see Phil Collins once, and he opened with In the Air Tonight. You see Lionel Richie, and he opens with Easy. Lead with the hits is what I was always taught. All right, Dan Carlin, when I say the name Gavrilo Princip, what comes to your mind right away?
Oh, boy, how one guy can change the whole world. I mean, and how scary it is that one guy can change the whole world. I think we like to think that that we're a little bit insulated from some rogue individual being able to throw all of our lives into turmoil, and it's just another example, like Lee Harvey Oswald, if you buy mm-hmm. that attitude, that one person can make an enormous difference, either for good or, you know, spark a fire that we still haven't quite stamped out completely today.
Robert Oppenheimer.
Ooh, I always think of that line, and we quoted it in the podcast. It wasn't Oppenheimer's line, but it was one of his colleagues, that for humankind to survive, we're going to have to grow into a higher level of greatness or something. And I love that because I still haven't figured out in my own head if collectively we can grow into a higher level of individually we can all grow and evolve and become wiser or whatever, but I don't know if collectively we can, and mm-hmm. I actually think about that quite a bit. So It's not Robert Oppenheimer, I think about it, one of his colleagues, though.
Very good. Someone who you maintain ruined a fiction for you, Alexander the Great.
Well, Alexander, you know, I have a weird relationship with him. And I had a very liberal professor in college that said, why is it that, and he was speaking of himself and his colleagues, why is it, he said, wishy-washy liberals have such an enormous respect and admiration for all these terrible figures in history. And Alexander's one of those things, that it's like a guilty pleasure, like watching boxing. I can't figure out if Alexander is a butcher and a tyrant or the philosopher king, and he's given me way more joy than I think any of his victims thousands of years ago would have liked to have known that he's given me.
We talked about that with vis-a-vis sports backstage a couple of seconds ago. That's where your head knows something and your heart feels something different, and there's that tug between the two. All right. I almost named my child after this gentleman, this character. Captain Quint.
Captain Quint, I don't recall.
Jaws.
Oh. So the Captain Quint thing, I always think of Robert Shaw, the actor who played the role. And I saw a documentary with Robert Shaw once, and I guess he died at 51 of a heart attack on the side of the road in Ireland, but he had said at 48, they'd asked him about how long he could go, and he said, well, it's all about energy. And he was talking about how energy fades as you get older and that everything is a facet of your ability to gather enough gumption and energy and verve, for lack of a better word, to get things done. And I think about that a lot at the end of the five-hour podcast when we're at the end of our rope and I say, I hope we can finish this thing before it finishes me. So I think about Robert Shaw more than the character.
Our second child, his name is Brody Quinn, and I almost got two. I almost got Brody and Quint, my two favorite characters, Captain Quint and Sheriff Brody. My wife said, "You're not getting two. You're not getting two Jaws characters. You're only getting one."
I just met a kid whose name is Saxon, and I thought that's the greatest name. And I thought, unless you're going to call him Jute or something, but that's a little different, you know.
George Orwell.
I don't know what to think about the whole Orwell thing. Orwell's one of those guys where, I don't know if you read 1984, but he's part of a group of authors that's not particularly exhilarating to read in terms of the word style, and it's kind of boring, and yet they're all substance people, and so what you're supposed to get from a guy like Orwell is the substance rather than the style. I don't know. You know, I get him and Aldous Huxley. You know, they're kind of like different sides of the coin. And I feel like we've kind of split the difference between the future as those two guys have seen it. I think we're about halfway Orwell and about halfway Huxley.
Joe Rogan.
Joe's one of those guys that has helped a lot of people, including yours truly. And so in the same way that I feel really thankful that you're all here and care enough to be here, I owe Joe about a million favors. And he's done a lot of things for a lot of people. And so I just feel grateful. He to this day, he still does favors for me. I've never returned any of them, just so you know. I owe a lot of favors.
The Twilight Zone.
Oh, okay, so somebody told me something, and I've never confirmed if it's true, but you know how I always use that Statue of Liberty in the sand thing? Yeah. I was told that Serling actually wrote that, in the Twilight Zone, that he was the writer who put that scene in there, and I thought, that is just so perfect. What I like about the Twilight Zone and Rod Serling, just so you guys know, and it's kind of I use this for my own show, is that every Twilight Zone is different, and yet when you watch it, you know it was the Twilight Zone, and that's kind of how we try to do it too, where every one of the podcasts is kind of, I hope, different, but at the end of it, you knew, okay, that was Carlin's stuff. So I actually love that show, and I love the creative mind behind it.
End quote.
You know, there's a whole bunch of interesting things that we had to develop when we started doing this podcast, because there were no metrics, and we call those quotes audio footnotes in-house. And the reason we did them was because I'm not a historian. I tell you guys that all the time. And so why on earth should you trust when I tell you something? And so we started to use these writers and these authors and these experts as a way so that, you know, in between my spiel, we would have somebody you could trust that would say, okay, this happened or this did. So then how do you know when it's me talking or it's them talking? So the quote, end quote thing happened there, and now, of course, you know, I'm stuck with it. That's the problem when you do these sorts of things. They become sort of expected. So when I was doing the book and I read the audio book version of it, we had this long discussion about whether or not you do the quote, end quote thing for the audio book, and there were some interesting angles, and one guy said, well, you know, it's expected, and another guy said, we don't do that in audio books. And so, to be honest, I blanked out during the whole thing. I don't remember what we did, so you guys will have to remind me.
I always thought that'd be great on a tombstone, by the way, just end quote.
End quote?
Yes. I'm not going to make this too political, but I do want to ask you about a very political program from the 70s. I think we have a mutual admiration for. All in the Family.
Oh, wow. I had a conversation with somebody about that show a while back where we were talking about, you know, the funny thing about All in the Family, right, is it's something that started in the early 70s. And I read an article somewhere that said that it's still too controversial now to put on a lot of stations. And it doesn't run in rotation as much as you would expect it to, because even though it's funny that it was controversial for a completely opposite reason at the time. Now it's controversial because you can't even address those issues that way anymore. But I feel like I was talking to the guy, one of the showrunners from Game of Thrones, Dan mm-hmm. Weiss. And they had this idea for a Confederacy wins the war kind of, I don't know if it was a TV series or something like Game of Thrones. Yep. And the idea was, it was going to be a way, not that I want to give anything away, but it was going to be a way to hold a mirror up to our times now and sort of explore some issues through that kind of story. And I said to him, it's like an All in the Family thing, but in a dramatic, sort of interesting, fast-paced kind of way. And it was actually shot down before anybody got any farther than the idea stage. And the one thing I remember him saying to me was, you at least could have let us draw up a proposal. I mean, they didn't even let... And the funny thing was is that the writers that he had already lined up were all African-American writers. I mean, he had tried to do it in a way that would make it possible, and it still wasn't possible. It's an interesting time we live in.
Do you think it's possible to do a podcast about, in that spirit, do you think it's possible to do a podcast then about the Civil War?
Yeah, I don't think I could do it, to be honest. And it's only because I lack the knowledge. But I think that somebody could, and I think somebody will. You know, that's the kind of thing that you want to have, like a Rashomon kind of thing, where you see it from multiple... I always say Rashomon, and then half the crowd gets that, and they say, or the Gilligan's Island episode, where there's the crime on the island, and then you get to see how every person on the island saw the crime differently. I think that's... I would do the Civil War from the Confederate side, then from the Union side, and then I would love to have, like, two other sides. One, the European view of it, mm-hmm. and also the South American view of it, because one thing... Americans often forget is how long slavery persisted in South America. In Brazil, there's a theory that it actually retarded technological growth because they didn't need it, right? If you had people to do it, you didn't need to have systems to do it. And so for a long time, they just used people. The original labor-saving device, I think we called it.
Finally, before we get into our conversation, what goes through your mind when you hear the name Dan Carlin?
Wow.
Can the subject be an object of its own inquiry?
That's a hard one because...
Yeah.
They can stay. It's okay. I don't have an answer to that. And, you know, it's funny because you did say I have a problem with the compliments. Like, it's not a problem. I just don't know what to say, and I just feel lucky. So when you say Dan Carlin, I just think... I really don't think of the podcasting or the business. I just think of mm-hmm. my kids and my life. And I mean, that's the part where you go home... that all of this makes possible for me. And so, I mean, that's just, it's like a personal thing. I just think of my family.
When you think of all the downloads and you look at this audience tonight.
You guys are so nice to
us. Hang on though, but honestly, like seriously, not to gush too much, but does this kind of feel like a victory lap? You started this in 2005.
Yeah.
And here you are in another country filling a theater.
My wife asked me once, she said, do you feel vindicated? And I just said, the only emotion is just relief. You know, you're just glad you didn't screw up. And you know how life is. I mean, you take these leaps, and the leap before the podcast leap failed. So, you know, that old line about Churchill talking about, you know, you have to keep persevering, and it sounds like a cliche. But my wife would have been totally justified after the business mm-hmm. endeavor we tried earlier failed. She could have said, okay, if that's it, you're going to go get whatever talk radio job they'll hire you, whatever city they'll hire you, that's it. And instead she said, no, go ahead and try this thing. And of course, you know, for years, we didn't even ask for donations for years. I mean, it was just years of trying to figure out. And we didn't do the history show for a little while either. We did the political show. And then we said, you know, I don't know what we're going to do long term for this. And thought, okay, well, maybe we'll just tell people that they can send in a buck a show if they want to. And they did. And that was the part, because I asked... I'm the kind of guy that will go ask experts for opinions, right? And then I'll weigh what they say. And I went to about 20 people that I really admired, lawyers, professionals, all kinds of people. And to a person, they said, this will not work. And I did it anyway, which is stupid, right? So what's the lesson here?
Did you save any of those letters? Please tell me.
It wasn't letters. They were personal meetings. And it was always so funny because this was the common look that they gave me right after I answered the question. Like, how do I answer this guy who's already invested heavily in this that it's stupid? So, you know, I don't want to tell you to go do something all the experts tell you is stupid, because that would be stupid. And at the same time, it is a kind of a lesson that, was it Henry Ford who said, I didn't ask the public what they wanted because they would have said they wanted a faster horse? It's a little like that, where the people that I was asking, they didn't know what podcasting was. Podcasting wasn't what it is now, and they couldn't see the future. And I can't blame them for not seeing the future, but I have no idea why I didn't just chicken out, because that would have been my nature.
It's a great point. Huey Lewis, Whitney Houston on the radio, ask anybody if they want a punk rock, they'll say no, and then Nirvana.
I wanted it. I just want you to know. I still want it. If it comes back.
Let's get into a couple of things. One thing that you wink at, and questions coming up, and feel free again, fill out your cards and questions for Dan. One thing that you wink at in the book, and I want to give you a very specific analogy about it, because I love your boxing analogies. I think we all do. There's a great one that I've always sort of sideways snicker at, which is, show me a fighter with heart, and I'll show you a guy that gets beaten up a lot.
A catcher, they call those in boxing, by the
yes,
way.
It's good at catching. I want to ask you about toughness. Okay. It's two different types of toughness. There's the toughness where you can physically impose your will on someone, and I've always felt maybe something that's tougher is being able to withstand it. Through history, what is, in your opinion, the more austere version of toughness?
Well, let me tell you the reason I brought this up, because I have a lot of old history books, and I grew up reading old history books. And old history books, if you read them, are different than new ones, because historians used to consider it part of their purview to talk about things like people losing resiliency or gaining it, and tough times make tough. All that sort of stuff 100 years ago, a historian would have thought that that was within their realm of expertise. Now, of course, we do better history than we ever did before, and we have radiocarbon dating and peer-reviewed studies, and everything is proven. And when you're talking human history, there's things that just don't fit into the quantifiable, you know, aspects of it. And one of it is toughness. And toughness is a weird thing. Somebody criticized me once, and they brought up Joe Rogan. They said it's like a bro kind of thing to talk about toughness. But when you read the old history books, you know, Hans Del Brook wasn't some bro guy when he was talking about toughness. He saw something that he thought 100 years ago was an element that mattered. He might have been wrong. But nowadays, if you decided toughness was important, and you could even define it, right? I mean, what the hell is toughness, right? Is it resiliency? Is it warlike? You know, we don't even know what. And if the Spartans are considered tough, are they only tough against other Greeks? I mean, would they be tough against Aztecs? So it's not something you can define, and there's no answer to it. But I think if you were to meet, and I think we used in the book the example, if you had two boxers who met each other, and every single aspect was the same except the question of toughness, you know, or if every single aspect of the same, you know, and somebody won, what would you blame it on? And so I find it interesting, because I feel like it's part of that realm. A storyteller and a person who asks questions can get into that a professional can't anymore, because, you know, you're not just allowed to have an opinion as a professional. You have to have data and facts. And so much about us and the society we build and who we are emotional and have a lot of things that are just unquantifiable. And so to me, the toughness is the perfect example of one of those questions.
It's interesting the way it changes as well, the idea of toughness culturally and even through countries as well. Margaret Atwood, 1972, wrote a wonderful book called Survival, where she talked about the various ethos through literature. And in England, it's the, you know, analogy of the island and the isolation. And in America, it was all about conquering, go west and tame the land. Whereas in Canada, it was all about endurance, geographically huge, spread out population. It had to endure four very distinct seasons, and that's very much the ethic so much in Canada. When you trace through history, who endured the most? Who was able to endure from your research, your reading, your podcast? Who was able to typify what Atwood talked about in 72?
I'm going to give you my best impersonation of a politician here and totally veer off from what you asked, because I got caught up in the question halfway through it, and you got me thinking about it. Because one of the things about toughness that is interesting is that when we think about it, like when I talk to another guy about it, I think we think about it as a very male tendency, and the warlike aspect is part of that.
Yeah.
But when you think about other ways you can define toughness, resiliency, right? And that's when I start thinking about all the women through human history. I was just reading a book on John Adams and his son, John Quincy Adams, and a lot of the book focused on his wife, Abigail Adams, and the fact that John Adams was gone so often that she had to raise her kids, and she was writing letters, you know, under the pseudonyms that they did during the Revolutionary War, mm-hmm. and she was doing all these kinds of things in an era where women couldn't do that kind of stuff. And then to have fighting and cannonballs exploding right outside the house kind of thing, and I remember thinking,
it's one thing to be John Adams and getting all the accolades and all that other kind of stuff. There's a payoff for his resiliency. This is a person who's resilient because she has to be. There's no accolades, there's no kudos. And the number of human beings, men and women, that have been trapped in those situations. So it's not a, I don't want to pick out some famous person, because I think most of the people who fall into that category, their names have never made it into the history books. And that's why when we talk about getting caught in the gears of history, generally great, powerful people aren't as trapped in the gears of history as regular average people are. And so I feel a little bit more sympathy for the people who have no say in it. And that's most of us.
One of the interesting things that, and you do this in your podcast as well, and you do it in the book, I come from a sports background, so one of the things we never talk about is luck, because we want to pretend that we understand everything and can explain everything, and everything has a very logical reason why it happened, when really a large part of things like sports, or I would imagine military battles, would be luck. How much of a wild card in everything that you've done or written about is luck?
You know, as everyone knows, it's kind of hard to figure out, right? What is the, there's an old line about, you know, preparate, you make your own luck, kind of, or my grandmother used to say, you get lucky when you go knock on a bunch of people's doors and continually knock until somebody answers. Well, are you lucky, or did somebody who didn't knock on anybody's doors and never get anything, are they unlucky? So there's a place where luck and preparation meet, and it's hard to know, you know, where that, because it's different in every situation. Some people are just straight up darn lucky, and some people are unlucky and make it anyway and manage anyway, and most of us are somewhere in between. My dad had a line I like to use, though. He said, if you look back on your life from the end of it, and you try to connect the dots from the beginning, he says, you'll never be able to do it, because there's too many weird places in your life where you're going to make a left-hand turn out of nowhere that you never saw coming. Now, I don't know if that's luck or fate. I described it to somebody once, though. We were trying to figure out an analogy for it, and I'm sorry if I use an analogy that makes no sense to most of you, but there's a ride at Disneyland, and it's a car ride, and you feel like you're in charge of this car, but there's a track, right? It allows you to steer to the left and allows you to steer to the right a little bit, giving you the illusion of control. But when that left-hand turn comes and you have to turn, the track makes you turn. Mm-hmm. And so I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out, when you look at historical figures, how much of what Alexander the Great was going to do was on the track, and how much of it were decisions he made, and how much of it is a combination of the two.
And one of the things you do as well is you put everybody, and we've all had this experience listening to the podcast, is taking people and putting them in that situation and saying, well, now what would you do? Now what would you do? Because and that's where I say to myself, is Dan Carlin really doing history here?
To be honest, I think that's one of the most effective things, because I think, you know, I always say that the way that I do the show is the way that people who already like history often think about it. And that what, if we've been able to do anything, it's to, let me start a different way. I had a guy who was talking about meditation once, and I can't meditate. I'm one of those people that have tried, just can't do it. And he was saying that some people need help. They need something to jumpstart them. And I feel the same way about history, that some people are born, my brain just is organized that way. I have a friend who's into math. His brain is organized in a mathematical sense. Mine's in a contextual and linear sense. And the history majors that I had class with, theirs was often the same way. Those people don't need any help. They don't need any help to meditate or to understand. But there are people that never thought of history in the sense of, what would you do in that situation? And that's when you kind of go, oh, yeah, that's kind of interesting. I mean, it just tilts it a little bit, and that's enough for some people to all of a sudden, it opens the door for them to start, the dominoes start tumbling.
See, I say that as a compliment, too. Not like I'm saying, oh, you're not doing what you set out to do here, Dan. Like, that's actually a compliment. Like, honestly, like, I think some of the best people in any, certainly in my field, are the ones that they say they're talking about sports, but they're really talking about
it's a metaphor
ethics.
For life.
It's a metaphor for how we're behaving amongst each other, and would we make the same decisions?
I do think when we talk, like, one of the reasons I'm not doing the current event show right now is I feel like everyone's, and this is, you know, this is different for a Canadian audience than for a U.S. one. Everything is so knee-jerk, and everybody's very defensive in the States right now. And so to try to, I have no interest in preaching to the choir, as they say, right? I don't care to talk to a bunch of people who already agree with me. But it's a time when it's very difficult to get people who don't agree with you to even listen very long. And without having truth that we can agree on, it's hard to have a conversation. It just devolves into, I don't like your sources, you don't like my sources, and it's all fake news. But I do think that there are other ways to get beyond those defenses, right? Because they're very knee-jerk. So it's when if I talk politics with you, or if I talk parties with you. But I think we can talk about times where you see similar sorts of, you know, it's not history, doesn't repeat itself, but it sometimes rhymes, the old line. I feel like there are time periods where there are echoes that seem familiar. And I feel like we can talk about those things and sort of circumnavigate the knee-jerk defenses in a way that, that provides context. And then I'm not telling you what to think, but I am giving you a chance to understand better the surrounding influences that help you maybe to see the bigger picture.
Curious about the editing as well, because whatever goes into a podcast or this book, I mean, everything is edited. You're choosing to use this footnote. You're choosing to use this author. Dr. Andrea Ospina once said, "I don't believe people who tell me they know things. I believe people who tell me they're temporarily confident in their current interpretations." Essentially getting at what is a fact. How do you choose that, Dan?
Reminds me of the John Maynard Keynes line, where the great economist was coming out of a building, I think, and this is the story anyway. Sometimes I tell these stories that I get emails saying, that never happened, it's a myth. It's normal. But the story is that he comes out of this meeting and somebody goes up to him and accuses him essentially of flip-flopping, right? You changed your mind on something. And the response was something to the effect of, when the facts change, I change my opinion. What, pray tell, do you do, sir? And that's how I look at it, too. I mean, we have a saying that wisdom requires a flexible mind. I don't know how you can consider yourself intelligent or wise if your opinions are so set that if the data changed, you wouldn't change your mind. Mm-hmm. And I do think that a lot of my countrymen right now, we're in this place where it's become, you know, I use this word and I probably use it wrong because I only took one psychology class in college, but they called it a totem, right? Where it's part of your, it's part of your self-image and the way you see yourself. I'm a Republican or I'm a Democrat or I'm this or that. And if the facts change, well, then I have to ignore them because I'm still, yeah. You know, they used to say that the leather jacket I wore was a totem, right? It's who you think you are and it's part of your image. Well, I don't wear the leather jacket anymore. So, I mean, I think we're flexible in that respect. And so I do think that the flexible mind idea, what was the point of the question again, Jeff? Tell me again.
How do you?
This happens on the podcast too, just so you know.
By the way, Dan warned me backstage.
Yeah, I told him it was going to happen.
I'm going to go wandering. I'm going to ask you what the question was again. How do you determine what fact is? Like, how do you determine what is important that you use for
context? I don't determine what facts, just so you know. I don't feel qualified to do that. What I'll do is I'll say that this historian says this, yeah. And this historian says that. Now, I will choose some of those issues because they're interesting. I'll say, isn't it interesting that what you might think is a fact is not? And I was telling Mike, who I came here with, that I get emails from other countries. Now, this is something that never happened to me in talk radio. You could talk about something going on in Iran in the local talk radio, and you might get an email from an expatriate or two. But if I talk about Iran on the podcast, I'm going to get 100 emails from Iran, and probably from like some assistant deputy secretary of, and telling me how wrong I have it. But like right now, there's a resurgence in Russia of a very nationalistic sort of version of their history. And so if I said something like, you know, Stalin was a evil tyrant, I wouldn't say evil, but I would say, you know, something like a tyrant or a dictator, I get emails from them saying, you know, this is just typical propaganda. And so it's easier for a guy like myself to just say, well, here's one of, you know, I don't want to give you the Stalin was a great, nice human being opinion, but I mean, when you're a non-expert, and that's how you sell yourself. I'm not trying to put anything over on anybody. I think the way a journalist does it, and that's my background, is to sit there and go, okay, you have this attitude, and you have this attitude, and here's what this outside person says. And I feel like that helps a lot of people out there sometimes. Like somebody told me that they didn't know that there wasn't just one straight-up linear view of history that was dead-set truth set in concrete. They didn't realize that it really is like our time now. I mean, I always explain it like news, and again, this might be an American thing, but we have left-wing news channels in the United States, and we have right-wing news channels in the United States, and I always say, what would happen if only one of those broadcasts made it into the future, right? If they viewed our whole society now through the lens of one of those TV stations. And I said, that's kind of how history is sometimes. I mean, if you only find stuff from one side of the equation, well, they'll write sometimes history from that side of the equation.
Then where do you see the world right now? Now, and here's how I want to couch it.
Did you read the book?
Twice, yes. Terence McKenna once said, if you consider we're descended from angels, you look around, you say the place is a mess. But if you think that we're also descended from chimpanzees, you say, what a curious accomplishment this is.
I really like that.
Is it
actually
a mess
that,
or
but I like
a curious
it.
Accomplishment? Where are we to arrive at this point right here, right now? Is it a mess or is it a curious accomplishment?
You know, it's an interesting question. I think we did a show on learning how to live with our nuclear weapons, the destroyer of worlds. And I really, that was, you know, a lot of these shows are about subjects I've thought a lot about, so it doesn't make me think a ton about them to do them again. But that show, I've thought a lot about since, because I really feel like if there's any, there's anything that affects our future right now, it's this question, like we said earlier, growing into a higher level of greatness. Because I have great confidence in each and every one of you that you could do that. But I don't have a lot of confidence that you all as a group could. And that's where the problem lies, I think. And I don't know how, there's a difference between us as individuals and us as the herd. When I look at history, I don't find that it's predictive on an individual level at all. So I don't find that history tells you anything about the individuals. Mm-hmm. But in terms of telling us about the herd, I'm not sure we're different than we ever were. I mean, I went up to a herd of horses once. And horses, I don't know if you've ever had a horse. Horses are very interesting animals individually, and they're all different. But the herd, they're reliable. I mean, you can make a noise in the whole herd, and one of them's going to stampede, they're all going to move. Yep. And I feel like we're a little like that. So when you talk about how well we're doing, I think on the individual level, I think we probably have more, for lack of a better word, because I don't know what we're after here, enlightened people, wise people, intelligent and learned people than we've ever had in human history. James Burke said that to me, the science historian, once. He said, we've never used more of our collective brain power than we use now, because most people were always frozen out, right? They were having to work the land, or they were peasants or whatever. So now we have more individual brain power than ever. But if I could replace all of you here with a group of ancient Egyptian people, I'm not sure that as a group it would be all that different. So that's what's strange. So
In what way?
But like when we talk about nuclear weapons, right? And we have to grow into greatness to handle the power of our weapon system. If we had a dictator, if we had a Roman emperor, like I don't know how many of you ever read anything Marcus Aurelius wrote, but he's one of my favorite ancient rulers, because when you read his stuff that was really only intended almost like his own daily reminders, it was never meant for us to read. But when you read it, you think, oh, wow, I would love a person like that in charge. I would love somebody like that to have total power, because they just seem so wise and they could get great things done. But then the problem is that, you know, with any system like that, that his kid was an idiot, right? And so therein lies the problem, right? So you can't depend on that. And so when we talk about, I would imagine that if I replaced all of you with ancient Egyptians, they're going to be less well-read, less learned, know less facts, less about the world, but if a firecracker went off over there, you're all going to stampede toward the door, and so are they. And so I guess what I'm saying is that if we have to grow into greatness to survive, I have confidence that many of you can do that. I don't have confidence that we can all do it together. And so that's kind of what scares me about that. So when you say, are you pessimistic or are you optimistic?
Sure.
It's going to be interesting, because I'm a person who believes in democracy, and I believe that the people should sort of make the decisions, but I don't have a lot of confidence in them at the moment.
In 2007... TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
I think the purpose of this talk before we get to audience questions is a couple things about the book, some about the podcast, and some about you as well, and your ideas on things, and certainly under the umbrella of history, since that's why we're all here today. You've addressed this before, but can you elaborate a little bit more on how you think history should be taught?
Oh, yeah, I have some strong feelings about this. I was lucky enough, and I told him not to. I declined him. There's an education foundation that I think it's George Lucas runs, called Edutopia, and it's just educators. And they asked me to write that exact a piece on that exact question. And I said no. And I said no because I said the last thing I want to do is write to a bunch of educators how they should be teaching history. And they said, well, no, we're looking for your outside the box thing. And so what I basically said, and you know, this is a guy, I'm a guy who loves the traditional way to teach history, so it's really tough for me to say, don't learn it the way I learned it, because I love the way I learned it. But truthfully, if we examine it with some common sense, if you'll pardon the pun, some person had to sit in a room and decide what facts you needed to learn and be tested on, right? Columbus discovering the New World in 1492, everybody should know that. And my reply in that article that I wrote for Edutopia was, yeah, but what if you forget it 5 minutes after you leave the class, right? Mm-hmm. So if you need to know this because you need it to be an informed citizen, but you learn it for the test and forget it, you're still not an informed citizen, and you wasted all that time. You know, get me back to this point, because I'll forget where I was going, but I find it fascinating.
I read Mein Kampf about once a year, which I know is a crazy thing to do. Yeah, I read a bunch of weird books every year. Like, it's crazy. When you read a book by Adolf Hitler, to find yourself agreeing with anything Hitler said is extremely troubling. But Hitler has a couple of paragraphs on the uselessness of the way they teach history in the schools, and he says basically what I just said right there, which is a little upsetting, but it just shows you how long the critique has been around, right? What's the point of filling that? We could be using that time so much better if we taught them. So what I said in the Edutopia article was, if you want to give students something of practical value that they can use the rest of their lives, it's the difference between, I think, like addition and subtraction versus trigonometry, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes you have to use trigonometry, but we all need division and subtraction. So, I mean, what we had said in the book was, teach a historical process. So everybody has something they love, and that has a history itself. So let's just take two things, motorcycles and fashion, right? You show a young boy a motorcycle from the first motorcycles, or you show or anybody a dress from years ago or pants from years ago, and then show how we do it today, and then show how it went from A to Z. Now you're teaching context and development and the historical process. So if you get out of that classroom understanding how things develop over time, in other words, how things unfold, how they get to places, the number of detours involved, and then you've got something that you can apply to other circumstances, so that you may not know that Columbus discovered America in 1492, but if you really need to know that, you'll go find that out yourself, whereas everybody kind of needs to understand how things develop. And that's kind of what history sort of shows.
That's a fantastic explanation. You mentioned the Hitler topic, and there's, you know, you've talked about the difference between, that's history, right? You mentioned the difference previous about Alexander the Great and Adolf Hitler. Do you look at history much like we look at movies? There is the good guy and the bad guy. There are the heroes and the villains. And have you thought what goes into making a great villain? Like, what are the ingredients that go into making a villain? I think of something that, you know, Plato would always talk about, how people have a natural desire to do good. That is everyone's default setting. Everyone has a desire to be good and do good. The problem occurs when we realize not everyone has the same definition of good, and you realize, and you see this in movies, that the greatest villains are often heroes, but in their own story.
Okay, so now you get me to the very first Hardcore History episode we ever did, which was 20 minutes long, which shows you what I thought I was going to do. And just as a little aside, the reason that they're 5 hours long is your fault. I all want you to realize that, because what we said was, when we did the 20, so the concept behind the history show was, I was a history major, and we used to have these wonderful discussions at lunch and between classes, and there was a, you know, at the school I went to, they have this room where history majors can all hang out and have lunch, and you have these wonderful discussions, and I figured we were doing the podcast for those people. And so we didn't give any context at all. We just, you know, isn't it funny how when Hitler did this, but you don't tell any of the context. And I started getting the first feedback from that first show, and they were saying things like, we like that stuff, but we don't know the context. And so little by little, without trying to sound like a historian, we would add enough so that the Twilight Zone twists or whatever made sense. But the first show was a comparison of motives, and it was called Alexander versus Hitler. And the idea was, if you read Mein Kampf, the craziest part of Mein Kampf is that Hitler thought he was doing good, right? In his own twisted head, he thought this was going to make the world a better place. Whereas if what some have written about Alexander, because who the hell knows, is true, then Alexander's motivation may simply have been to create, you know, to write a bigger piece of historical graffiti, you know, on the great tree of history. And if you kill a lot of people because you think you're doing good, is there a difference between you and the guy who kills a lot of people because it's going to make his name bigger in the history book? And if you go to a trial, like a murder trial, or better yet, a trial where somebody's killed, the motive is going to be a huge part of, you know, how long you get sentenced for. And if it's in self-defense, you might not even get sentenced. So we were trying to examine, and I think the last line, and this is years ago, in that podcast was, what a blasphemous thought. Because, you know, what if Alexander's worse than Hitler because he had motivations that were more base, even if Hitler was the worst guy in terms of body counts, yep, or the actual evilness of creating a mechanized
killing machine like he did. And so I don't have any answers, as you well know. And as a matter of fact, if you're getting this book for answers, you're in big trouble. It is a book of questions, right? Because that's what I can do as a journalist. And these are questions that have no answers. I mean, if I say, can mankind live with the power of its continually more deadly weapon systems, there is no right answer, but it may be the most important question you can meditate on.
The answers one is interesting, and that just reminded me of a conversation I had, Jesus, about maybe 15, maybe 20 years ago with Ross Greenberg, who was then the president of HBO Sports. I was interviewing him on talk radio, and I said, you know, because we have a mutual love of boxing, Dan, and I said to him, you know, I can watch one of your hype videos for a boxing match, and you can get me excited about a fight that before I watched it, I had zero desire to watch. There's not a chance. I was buying this thing on a Saturday night and watching it. Not a chance.
Both guys have losing records.
Yeah, but these hype videos that they would make were remarkable. Like, what's the drug? What do you do? What do you put in these things? He said, the answer is very simple. I tell all of our producers, never answer a question. Don't ever ask a question. The fight on Saturday night has to answer all the questions. It's just your job to ask them, and that's it.
It's funny you say that, because now I'm replaying in my head all of the commentaries, the pre-fight commentaries I've heard
all
from HBO,
HBOs,
and they all make sense now.
It's all questions, and I've got to buy this thing on a Saturday night. Do you feel the same way when you do a podcast, or whether you write?
I'd like to have the answers. I'd love to be the guy who could get up here like some philosopher and tell you how it is. But there's that great line that Clint Eastwood uttered in one of his movies: "A man's got to know his limitations." And I think the funny thing about it is knowing your limitations helps you succeed, because you work around them. I mean, the funny thing about the format we have for Hardcore History, you and I were talking about this. We were talking about how your favorite television series was not what it is for the first 10 episodes, right? Seinfeld wasn't Seinfeld for the first 10 episodes. You have to grow into that. And I feel a little like it's a similar kind of thing where, Jeff, tell me what the question was again.
The question was about answering questions.
Yeah, okay, okay. Perfect. That could not have come at a better time. But the point was is that as we developed, and as I said, I never intended to even tell you the history of the story. So with listener feedback, you begin to start saying, okay, well, how do I do this, right? We talked about the audio footnotes earlier, right? How do I compensate for the fact that you have no reason to trust me on the facts, right? So you invent a tool, and then that tool becomes part of the thing, right? And so over time, I mean, people do this. It's funny to be a godfather of podcasting, right? Because it's actually taught me a lot about history, because it seems like it was just so much dumb luck at the right place at the right time and the timing and everything. And now I'm going back and looking at so many of my favorite figures and going, how much was dumb luck, you know, like I had, what he had or what she had? I think the questions are how I managed to talk about these things, especially since even if I was the most qualified academic historian in the world, I'm still not sure that you should take what I would say mm-hmm. without a grain of salt, because they disagree, right? So for a person who's not even that, the questions allow me to look at these issues. And if you can look at it from multiple viewpoints, then that puts not just the questions, but any answers you want to come up with in your hands, right? So I leave it up to the audience.
So how do you know when the podcast is done? Like, honestly, like, when...
You think I can answer that question? Have you heard the recent
ones? No, well, that's the thing. I said, I've done 3 hours. What's another hour? I've got more contacts. I've got more.
I knew I had this whole thing coming up, right? This whole book tour and everything else. So I knew we had to try to get the latest show out as soon as I could. And so I said, this is going to be a 3.5-hour show. It is a 5-hour show. and we are lucky it is only 5. And I said, I don't even mind that it's 5 hours. I mind that in 5 hours we didn't get very far. That's the part that drove me the craziest. But what ends up happening is, we don't have a script, right? I mean, this is a friend of mine who knows. He said it was performance art that's edited. And that is kind of what it is. But what that means is I can go in the studio one day. You know, I told you this. Sorry, I'm using lines I already used earlier on you this evening. I was a pretty good talk show host 2 days of the week. The only problem was I was on 5 days a week. So the fun thing about podcasting is that when I wake up on the wrong side of the bed one morning and I get in the studio and it just sucks, I don't have to give you that. right? In the old talk radio days, you got it good, bad, or indifferent. Now, it's a wasted day in the studio, but it's not wasted because it actually gets us to the version that works. We also leave a lot of stuff on the cutting room floor because we experiment. We don't know what's always going to work. And sometimes I try really weird things. And sometimes when they work, they're your favorite things. But when they don't work, well, that's 3 days wasted in the studio. we went down this tangent and we never came back. I have to tell you, you know, you should not be fascinated with your own work. There's something really weird about that. But you should like your work. And I love this because, and I've talked about the creative white space that podcasting is. I mean, you know, you and I come from talk radio backgrounds. Yeah. What if I said you got a 5-hour talk radio show today, but tomorrow it's 3 hours, and the next day it's 6 hours? And I mean, the fact that we can sit here and figure out what we think at the time, and that doesn't mean it is, but at the time, the best way to tell this story, or I can't go any farther anymore, or whatever it might be that shuts off the recording for that day, somehow it works out. And I don't want to say it always works out, but we did 26 hours on the First World War, which I thought was unforgivable. And that's people's favorite episode, if I had to name one. I do want to say, though, that when I did my first show that was ever over an hour, and I told you this too, so much of this conversation's already been had.
Did the show in the green room.
Yeah, that's right. But the first time I did a show over an hour, I think it was Apache Tears. And we put we inserted an apology to the listeners in the show because I thought it was just beyond bad taste to have wasted or used that much of the listeners' time. And you guys emailed me back and said, we have pause buttons. And I went, yeah, they do.
You can come back.
So if the shows are too long for you, you know who to blame, right?
Something that we sort of briefly discussed in the green room as well as we're splashing it all out, you're in McLuhan territory. Marshall McLuhan territory, University of Toronto. Born in Edmonton, moved here after he moved to Winnipeg, and you know, we always think the medium is the message, and that's a great, and you experienced this on Friday with Bill Maher trying to make a point about polls at the end, and boom, we're shut down and we're off to break. I want to get your thoughts on one of my favorite McLuhan lines, and it relates to television and radio. You can take it out to podcast if you wish as well. McLuhan used to say, if you say something on the radio, people will talk about what you said. If you say the same thing on television, they'll discuss the color of your tie. How do you react to that in 2019?
Well, I used to be a television reporter, and I was the most rumpled. I don't know if anybody remembers Columbo anymore, but that's what I looked like when they would go to me with a live shot in the field. And, you know, It was one of those things where I never was like I could never be aware enough of what my hands were doing, or even now, I'm still not sure. And then when I got into radio, I felt like it was so liberating because the only thing that mattered was what you were hearing. And that's where the whole theater of the mind part really came into play. And you talked about dead air, space, right? Pauses.
Silence. I think that's the one thing, by the way, that I think maybe we're all on the same page, but the one thing that Dan does better than any podcaster, and I can just tell you as a broadcaster, one of the great fears you have is silence. You think that the minute there is silence, everyone's going to click stop or turn off the radio or turn off the television, when quite the opposite is true. Maybe the only thing that gets people to lean forward now is when there's silence. There's such a wall of sound around us, the only way to get people to go like this is to stop talking. You do that really well.
We were talking about how a musician friend of mine, and maybe it's a common thing or maybe he made it up, I don't know, but he said silence is a note, right? It's something in your toolbox to use. I can't claim, I never took any classes on speech and debate. They tried to get me to take speech and debate because, you know, I'm a loudmouth and it's obvious. But I told them that I have an inherited skill that I can't take credit for. It runs in my family. I had an Irish grandfather who was a natural storyteller. And I was afraid that if they taught me the disciplined forms that go back to rhetoric, that it would mess up the natural thing, right? But the natural thing is a mixture of speeds, right? So I'm a fast talker, but then things will slow down, and then things will get quiet, and then we'll go back, and then loud and soft. Like, one of the things people complain about in the podcast, and I want you all to tell everybody why, somewhere online, is that we yell sometimes. We get real loud, and we get real quiet. When I was in radio, they have a natural thing that goes out on the station that's a compressor that takes your stuff, and pardon me, and squashes it, right? So the highs get lower, and the lows get higher. It makes it easier for you to listen to, but if you think about talking and speaking as like painting, then what you're doing is you're taking away the most extreme colors, right? You're taking away the bright reds, and you're taking away the dark blacks. And those are the things that, if you're a storyteller, those are the best tools in your toolbox. And so I just did a VR project, and Skywalker Sound did the project. And so I got to go to Skywalker Ranch and meet all of them. And of course, they're all super duper sound experts. And one of them comes up to me and says, "I really like the podcast, but I did email you to tell you about how you could compress that sound so you weren't so loud." And I thought, that's what I want to hear. One of the best sound people in the world telling me you can't listen to my stuff because of the highs and lows. But if you could do a side-by-side comparison and you heard a really heavily compressed version of my show versus what you're accustomed to hearing, you would see what you lose. And so for me, when I listened to my Irish grandfather, he wasn't from Ireland, he just had that thing. And it was a natural note, just you knew automatically when to speed up, when to slow down, when to get loud, when to get soft. And I didn't want any of those colors taken away from me. So I hope I don't blow your eardrums out. At the same time, I don't think you'd like it as much if we compressed it.
Mentioned end quote earlier, and that has become the signature. I don't know about you guys, but I can't hear anyone say end quote anymore. I hear it in Dan Carlin's voice. Maybe we're all the
ruined.
Same way. It's fantastic, Dan. This isn't a book reading, but can I ask you to read a paragraph from this book?
I read the whole darn book.
There's one specific, though.
Okay.
I shared this with you back. That is a very Dan Carlin paragraph, if that makes sense. And I even wrote here, Carlin passage. It's from the opening of Judgment at Nineveh.
All right. Let's see.
You got this.
I did do the audiobook, and I just want to know, if any of you hear it, can you tell the difference between me reading a scripted thing word for word and the podcast? I'll be interested. All right, so it's the whole paragraph or just the line?
Where are you?
Right there.
From there to that. That's the Dan Carlin line right there.
Live performance. Yes. All right. 21 years after Planet of the Apes was released, at an excavation of the city of Mosul in northern Iraq, archaeologists from the University of California began slicing into what, to the naked untrained eye, appeared to be a naturally occurring hill. But like so many other mounds in the area, it was actually a man-made stone and brick structure that the passing of thousands of years had worked to transform. Underneath 25 centuries worth of dirt, evidence of disaster was revealed. A layer of destruction and burnt material just beneath the soil. Pieces of weapons were discovered, and a corridor of sorts emerged, with cut stonework and a pebbled floor. Then the archaeologists found the dead. That work for you?
That last one was fantastic, that drop.
That was weird. I just want you to know. It's a lot easier to do that in the studio without you here.
I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of three teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
You've just created the playground where predators can really thrive.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
Listen to Sweethearts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get podcasts.
Find your frequency.
What type of feedback do you get? Now, Friday, I would imagine, after the latest podcast comes out, Friday is a day where you just want to not do anything, but you had
to... Comatose is a good way to put it.
What's the feedback you get normally when something like that comes out?
Well, it's a really weird feeling. I always compare it to what it must have been like, what maybe it is like, to record music. Because if you're a band and you're recording, shows you my age, a record, an album, a CD, a track, usually by the time you release it, you've heard it a bazillion times. You've heard all the versions you threw out and didn't use, so they're all mixed up in your head. And you've lost all ability to judge it, what we say, with virgin ears, right? And so by the time we release these things, we have no idea what we have. And so the most important moment sometimes is the initial feedback to know that it's not a disaster. I mean, really, it could be a disaster, and we wouldn't know it by that time. And so it also makes it hard, obviously, to know what it needs or what it doesn't need by that time. So the one thing about not having a script is it sounds so much more natural. Like, I don't think that sounded natural, reading that. Like, that doesn't sound like what I would sound like. At the same time, the script is wonderful because it would help us be able to say, gee, on page 2, you already said this. Let's cross that out, page 4. But without any of that, you have to listen. You have to go, did we already say that earlier? earlier and then try to rewind? Or was that something we left on the cutting room floor? And so the biggest danger for us is when the ears go sort of blind on us, ear blindness, and we can't hear it anymore. So that initial feedback is the first inkling we have of whether it was good, bad, or indifferent. And I always describe the shows like if you have a band that you like, we'll take Led Zeppelin. Led Zeppelin has a bunch of albums, and some of them every Led Zeppelin fan likes, and some of them are, you know, kind of more niche things. But those niche things are some people's favorite things. So we have the shows that everyone likes, and then we have the ones that were, you know, some people were like this, and then other people will tell you, that was my favorite show. Mm-hmm. So you just never know. But so that initial feedback we get is really important, where we can sort of go, so it's okay.
That's kind of... Do you think that you have a sort of audio signature? John Coltrane, in when he improvised, would have these unique chord substitutions. They became known as Coltrane changes. Nobody else did them. In your own mind, again, I'm asking you to analyze yourself as I did off the top. Do you think you have any signatures?
I don't have any intentional ones, because that would involve, like I said, what I do comes naturally, so there's no like effort to sit there and go, now how am I going to say this, or how am I going to do that? So if there is a signature, it's the same signature you would notice with me over lunch. I mean, it would just be the way that I discuss things. And some people say sometimes that when they see me on shows, or they hear me, like in this discussion, they'll say, God, he doesn't sound exactly like he does in the podcast. But the podcast is a monologue, and this is a dialogue. We just did a show where I talked about Douglas MacArthur, and how Douglas MacArthur would talk when it was just two people, like he was addressing a whole crowd and everything, and how bizarre it was to be in the room with him referring to himself as MacArthur and all these things. If I talked to you here the way we talk in the podcast, it would seem a little affected, don't you think? So there's a difference between a monologue and a dialogue, and so that's the difference. It's simply me standing up there. Like if I put this microphone in a stand and I stood up here and just sort of talked to you all alone, as we went along, it would probably start like a normal conversational voice, and then as we started going, it would start to get louder, and then you'd see the variations, and so that's the only thing. So if I have a signature style, it's the way I talk all the time, which is again why my kids have no idea why you guys want to hear this.
Speaking of signatures. Dan will be signing his new book here in a couple of moments, but we do have time for questions as well. I am getting the wave.
Love to take some questions. Thank you for coming out. I'd love to answer some questions.
All right. Okay. Here we go. Thank you. Okay. This comes from Mike C. Dan, given how modern society seems more immune to societal collapse than our ancestors, what would you say we are most at risk of? Global financial collapse, technological collapse, or... can societal collapse be the most likely?
It's a complicated question, because he's right. I mean, at one point, we have more redundancy. So one of the things we talk about in the book is the collapse of the Bronze Age, which is an interesting situation because there are parallels, right? It's a very complex society that might have crumbled simply because of the complexity. And in that case, you look at our society and go, wow, we're a lot more complex than they are, so the danger must be much greater. But there's a resiliency and a redundancy that we have built into ours that allows us the idea to say, well, you know, we'll survive in ways that they couldn't. I mean, we had great depressions and it didn't kill us. But we have things that they didn't, right? You have nuclear weapons, or I'm more scared of biological weapons, actually, in the long run. So I think when you talk about the various ways we could go down, I was talking on Mara's show, we were supposed to talk a little, and we never got to it, about Facebook's new currency, or maybe we did get to it, and whether or not that was a danger. And I was thinking that it's just one of the many things that opens up the door to the unknowables, right? It doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. There's always a trade-off, right, between innovation and stability. But I do think you open up the... I mean, I think, look at it this way. We don't have the same problem that some of the more repressive societies have with things like social media. Social media has been a strain on our societies, kind of, but look what it's doing to Iran and Russia and China and more repressive societies. That is a door opening, for as far as they're concerned, to something completely destabilizing them. I mean, my stepfather used to say the best way to destroy the old Soviet Union wasn't militarily, it was to drop, you know, Playboy magazine, blue jeans, and Elvis Presley records, and they'll do it themselves. And I think that's maybe the fear that people in some of these more repressive regimes have with the social media. I think that the combination of our society being more resilient is offset by the number of new threats and things we have that are potential dangers. So I think it's maybe a wash in the long run.
The podcast, one of the last ones you did, the one Final Common Sense podcast with James Burke, talked about some of these
things.
But the interesting thing about it, Dan, He had a way of calming me about it as I'm listening
to him. It's the voice. He has one of those voices that just calms you. He's one of the great, when you talk about interviews, one of the really fun little things of the job I have is you can call up somebody that you really admire, or have a little bit of hero worship, and sometimes they'll answer the phone, and sometimes they'll come on the program. And James Burke is really one of the few times where I was almost like, you know, just a little puppy dog about the whole thing. But he's one of those people that just, you know, when we talk about dream ideas about who you'd want to be put in charge of something, I always want these great minds like people like that who never get near government, right? I mean, you would think that they would stay away from it as far as, but I mean, I always have these fantasies of, God, wouldn't it be nice to have really intelligent, wise people in charge, you know, that I wake up.
Well, this goes a little bit, this winks at that question then. Unsigned, but Dan, who from ancient history would you most like to interview in person?
God, there's so many. I have, you know, we talked about Alexander earlier, but I get this feeling that Alexander wouldn't be that interesting. And I hate that it's so Western oriented. I apologize, because some of the people, there's a guy, Julius Caesar fascinates me. And he fascinates me because, you know, like, not to take it into politics, but I was talking about Donald Trump with somebody the other day, and they were saying, isn't he just the scariest guy you ever saw? And I said, no. I said, thank God he's not Julius Caesar. I mean, thank God he doesn't have one of these minds where, you know, he's, what Caesar supposedly could dictate three letters at the same time while talking. I mean, the things that these people could do. And so I'm fascinated with how often minds like that come along and then how they're used. So is Leonardo da Vinci the same kind of mind but applying it to a different genre, right? Mm-hmm. So the kind of people I'd like to meet are, I really would love to know what somebody like, could I even talk to somebody like that, right? I mean, or I won't say who it was. I was in a conversation the other night with a super intelligent human being, and I remember going to the conversation. I'm on the way to meet him, and I just thought, am I going to be able to say anything to this person that isn't just horribly stupid? If he's not just looking at me the whole time going, okay, I'll try to answer. So, I mean, so some of these people I'd really like to sort of take the measure of, and I think of Caesar a lot because the ancient sources don't tell me enough for me to get my mind around him. But, and then there's, you know, the fanboy stuff. I mean, you know, there's a bunch of figures from history that just fascinate me. Might be terrible human beings, but sure. I'd love to sit down with them and just sort of, you know, take the measure.
Quick follow-up then, time travel question. Would you rather go backwards or forwards?
Forwards.
Why?
Dentistry. It's I can't handle the thought of some of those things in the past. I can't even go back to when I was a kid. I tried to explain to my kids the other day just what dentistry was in the 1970s. They went, ooh.
From Sean, you tell it in a dramatic, captivating, and succinct way. Whom and what experiences do you credit as influencers of your style? I hear Rod Serling in your voice on the podcast sometimes. I do, yeah.
I do say, you know, and this is maybe a little object lesson for how interesting choosing majors in college could be. Because, of course, you know, there's no way I could have gone to college to be a podcaster. I was in college in the 1980s, right? But my majors were, I was a theater major for 2 years, and then I was a military history major for 3. And you say to yourself, that's 2 really different things. And yet somehow I use both of those things in every show I do. I kind of feel a little bit like you can't plan those things. Like, so when you say my style, some of it is, like I said, some of it's just genetic. It's just the way I talk. But the other part of it is taking these elements. I mean, theater teaches you even aesthetics. Like, I remember the course I couldn't stand as a theater major, because all you want to do is perform and those kind of things. But they make you take courses like aesthetics, like what, mm-hmm. what things look like and how they... I use that stupid aesthetics course every time I do a show. And so, I mean, I think... Give me the question again.
The question is...
That's going to be what everybody remembers from tonight.
What experiences do you credit as influencers? We talked about this backstage. You know, and you talked about this earlier, where Seinfeld wasn't Seinfeld. Yeah. About 15 episodes.
Oh, it was the listeners.
Yeah. Well, the Rolling Stones wanted to be a Muddy Waters cover band. And then all of a sudden, boom, we have this.
Yeah, well, a lot of it is your feedback. Because, when we started Hardcore History, and that was a year after we started Common Sense, it's 2006. And so if any of you were actually listening to podcasts in 2006 and you saw what was out there, I mean, I had a huge advantage just because I didn't spit into the microphone. I mean, that's the level we're talking about at the time. And so developing, I mean, you know, I've been doing talk radio for years. And one of the things when I did talk radio is that I always tried to turn my faults into strengths. And some of that was simply framing. So, you know, you always have that big voice. Well, Dan Carlin, blah, 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 whatever it was. And I always said, okay, I talk too fast, I talk too loud, and boy, you should have seen the VU meters back at the old radio station. And so I thought, okay, well, how can we make that part of the package, right? And so I would have the big voice announcer say, he's so loud. And so that became something that I just took something I was, it was a fault, right? It was something I couldn't correct. And we made it part of the style. And when I broke into radio, it was the very end of the big voice era. So they wanted everybody to sound like the big voice kind of guy. And I remember I had a meeting at the urinal with my boss once. I never saw the guy show up in the bathroom. And it was, and I'm on the air, right? So this is a commercial break. And silence, silence, silence. Ever thought about having your adenoids out? That was and I went, and then things caught up to, all of a sudden, 3 years later, everybody wanted to have the unique voice, right? Yeah. They wanted somebody that you're your own. Well, I already had that. We had the whole big voice guy sort of talk. He's loud. He's this. So it just, things caught up with me, I guess.
From Harrison, what are your big ideas about re-engaging our youth on the lessons of history? What have your children taught you?
I'm going to take that in a weird direction, because I don't think there are lessons in history per se, and I think any historian would tell you that. And I always use the same example, and I'm sorry if I've used this to you before specifically, but like in the United States, we love to pretend that there are lessons. And one of the lessons that you'll hear all the time on talk radio or whatever is, we learned from 1938 in Munich that you can't appease dictators. And I remember one of the friends I had in history said, no, you learned you can't appease that dictator in that situation specifically. It's the variables that prevent you from learning those kinds of specific lessons. The lessons we learn, though, are the ones we talked about earlier, how the herd works, right? People in large groups tend to behave predictably, and that's the part that you can learn from history. But in terms of very specific lessons about individuals, then it doesn't work.
You know, that is interesting, too. And man, so much of this about Twilight Zone and Rod Serling tonight for some reason.
I don't know how that happened.
By the way,
do you know that I did a Twilight? They just rebooted the Twilight Zone, and I was in it. And the character that I played was a variation of the name Rod Serling. So I got to be Rod Serling. Yeah, the guy finds a little iPod in the plane that he's in, and he starts listening, and it's telling him what's going to happen 5 minutes from now. And the guys who wrote the script made the host's name a variation of Rod Serling.
How'd that make you feel?
It was actually like a homage, you know.
Serling once, speaking of that, because he had 1938 dictators, and Serling said, listen, it's really important historically to keep Dachau open, to keep Auschwitz open. The Nazis tried to bury everything, vanish it, make it all go away. And if we allow that to happen, and his famous line was, then we become the grave diggers.
That sounds like him, doesn't it?
Completely.
You know, there's something weird about us, and that's that we forget very quickly. I don't remember who said it. It was somebody that said that, you know, it should not be too long, or we should be able to go look at the bodies again from time to time. So when the Allies liberated some of the concentration camps, they made the locals go walk through them. And of course, many of the locals had said they didn't know about them, and I'm not qualified to say whether they did or not. But the point was to show you, this is what happened. And it was the same thing here in the United States. When you would see, it was an era where they didn't show a lot of bodies and corpses and stuff, but you saw the bodies in the death camps stacked like cordwood, and it was sobering. How long does a lesson like that last? Does it last your lifetime? Yeah, probably. When your kid grows up, do they have to see the bodies too, or can you tell them about the bodies? And I didn't know the answer to that, but I'm starting to feel like, no, you need to see them yourself, or the functional equivalent of it, right? You need to live through one of those things that just stuns you, and that stays with you. It's weird that that's what's required. To get back to our boxing analogy, sometimes you just need to be really just hit in the face, and it stays with you for a while. And, you know, it's terrible. You don't want to have a whole bunch of bodies on the ground just to remind us we shouldn't have bodies on the ground, but I'm not sure there's another way to do it, you know?
As a foreman said after the Michael Moore fight, was the fight fixed? Of course it was fixed. It was fixed by my right hand.
That's right.
That's how it was fixed. Dan, how does our tendency to gloss over the carnage, gore, and unforgivable aspects of history affect how we interpret our past?
A lot. I mean, there's no other way. I mean, look, I think we talked about, and you guys have to forgive me, massive brain damage because I haven't rested since the last show, but there was a part where we were talking in the last show about, give me the question again.
How, Dan Carlin, does our tendency to gloss over the carnage, gore, and forgivable aspects of history?
Possum Patrol. Have any of you heard that show yet? It was the So I actually went and looked at the video after I said it came out years ago. It actually came out in 2001. And what it was, you know, I'm a nut, and I watch all the World War II video. I mean, you know, I probably saw every one of the standard black and white things that we all grew up with if you're old enough. But what there was stuff, and I didn't know this, there was stuff that the U.S. government didn't allow to be shown in the United States. And I grew up at a time where we thought everything was, you don't keep stuff from the Second World War classified. Mm-hmm. But what was kept classified was the fact that there was video or film of American soldiers doing what everybody does in war, the part that people don't talk about. And in this case, it was the going onto the battlefield afterwards and shooting all the wounded. Well, when I was a kid, the people that shot all the wounded were the bad guys. Well, we were the good guys in that war, and we were the good guys. But at the same time, if you get caught up in this idea that we are the good guys and we can do no wrong and all these sorts of things, it makes the other side almost seem like they're not the same species as we are, so we don't have to worry about ever becoming them. And at the same time, you also maybe glorify the Second World War may have been a good war, but it doesn't mean you did a lot of good things to win the war, and we should not glorify it as a way to say, let's go do the next one. Just that one went so well, let's just go do it again. I think you have to say to yourself, listen, a lot of people, and I grew up with a lot of those people, I'll tell a very quick story. My stepfather knew that I liked combat veterans, and I like to talk to them. And when I was a military history major, they used to bring them into class to talk to us. But the old rule of thumb is the more combat they saw, the less they'll talk about it. And then the more they saw, the more euphemisms they would use. And there was a great piece that appeared, I want to say, on the 40th anniversary of D-Day. And I only remember the title that my local paper slugged it with. And it was, "War's Biggest Cost is to the Soul." And the paragraph that stuck with me, and I think it was the first one, was it said, "You may live next to a mass murderer, but you don't fear them. You may live next to somebody who burned 50 people to death, but you're not afraid of them. And that's because they did it in the war. They did it for all the right reasons." But the point of the article, and it was by an army psychologist, was that you don't think about it, but that guy living next door to you thinks about it every day. And so my stepfather took me to meet this Pacific War veteran, and I've often found the Pacific War veterans somewhat different than the other ones. And he would not talk at all. I mean, my stepfather should have probably called first. But this guy was in his early 70s when I met him. And he drank pretty much from morning to night, and it had destroyed him, right? The life that he had lived afterwards in an attempt to cope with what he did in a good cause destroyed him. And so I think it's important. It's the same thing we have in the United States now, where I should tell another story. It's a weird one. I'll have to say that for another time, maybe. But I've met enough of these people where you go, it's very simple and easy and nice to say, we're going to tie a yellow ribbon around this tree and we support our veterans and all this. Mm-hmm. But we forget about what they did very quickly. And there was a guy, and he's the first voice you hear in that TV show, I mean, the thing with the Possum Patrol that I talked about earlier. It's called Hell in the Pacific, by the way. The very first voice you hear, and he's famous because they used him then in a bunch of documentaries after. He's like Shelby Foote was in the Civil War thing. He's such a compelling figure that everyone wanted him. His name is Eugene Sledge. He's dead now, but his nickname in the war was Sledgehammer. And he became this, he's this soft-spoken Southern guy, very cultured biology teacher, I think University of Georgia, something like that, really a likable figure. And he starts off this entire multi-part series by saying, the front line is where the war is. And he says, somebody who is 100 yards behind the front line doesn't know what it is. And he said, and no one who's never been there should ever send boys into combat because they have no idea what it is. And so I think, to answer your question, and for once I remember the question, by glossing over the evil deeds that even the good people have to do to fight evil, we make it more likely that we will send them there again, and we will send them there again thinking it's going to be grand, you know? My cousin, and we had a, it's funny, because when you're a military history major, you talk about war as often as you do. My cousin came to me before he was deployed to Iraq. And I said, you know, and we talked a lot about PTSD and everything else. He served 3 tours of duty, and he's not much better off than that veteran my stepfather took me to go see. And nobody cares anymore. I mean, you know, it's years later and whatever. But it's important to remember that wars cost, even a good war, and even a, I mean, look at the police officers that protect us every day and the things that they have to come home at night and remember and think and dream about and think about and try not to hurt their wives and affect their lives and all these other things. That's the danger of glossing over the bad stuff, is that somehow you'd look at the good cause you fought for and think it would be good to go do that without really having, because, you know, we're all 18, 19, 20 when you go fight these things. You're not exactly in really deep introspective mode most of the time. If we were more honest about it, I think it would help. For lack of a better word, we're not putting a value judgment on it, but we'd be more wide-eyed and open-eyed about it.
Want to give people a chance to meet you here and get some books signed.
I'd like to meet
really quickly. The end is always near. What is this? Is it a cautionary tale? Is it a cookbook to keep our Twilight Zone theme going? What is this book?
I wanted people to understand that we have a sense of invulnerability about us. And the funny thing about it is, I don't think ever before in history have we dealt more with the topics in this book. I mean, the funny thing is, if I talk to somebody about nuclear war or Armageddon or this, it's almost a tired theme in entertainment. Right on board, another thing about, you know, post-nuclear war, Armageddon, and whatever. So instead of doing, you know, when I was a kid, they had a show called, I think it was called The Day After or whatever. It was not a show, a movie, but it was like the first time that anybody had used really modern techniques to try to show what a post-nuclear war would be like. And it was stunning, and it made a lot of news, and everybody was really, you know, affected by it. I do think that in a funny way, instead of making us more aware and having that on the tip of our tongue and thinking about it more often, it's almost turned it into an entertainment theme that we just let pass by. And so by looking at these case studies, I was trying to show that one of two things is going to happen to us. Either the same things that have always happened before, or those things are never going to happen again. Take war. Either we're going to have another great war between the great powers like we always have, or we're not. And either one of those things is fascinating. And so the point of the book was to look at these and start to try to three-dimensionalize some of these things and remind you that they happened, they could happen again. And what happened to the people who went through them? And then there's two chapters that seem to make no sense. They probably should have been at the end instead of the beginning. But when we talk about the plasticity of human beings, so that when these things happen, how do we respond? So one of them is about how we raise children. And, you know, nowadays, look, we were talking about Stalingrad the other day with somebody, and we were talking about the children, the orphans of Stalingrad, who were running around the ruins in an almost Lord of the Flies situation when their parents are dead and they're trying to learn how to find food and whatever you might have to do. Well, if you're raising a child in Stalingrad, you're going to teach one skill set of survival skills. If you're raising a child today in Beverly Hills, you're going to teach another one. If the world all went to hell in a handbasket, could we raise Apaches again instead of computer geeks? So that's part of the plasticity of human beings. And the other one is the toughness question. Same sort of deal. If times got tougher, is that part of human adaptability to get tougher too? So are we as tough as we need to be for this time and this place? And if this time and this place got tougher, we would? So, I mean, again, we're not giving you any answers because I'm not qualified to do that, but it's a lot of the most interesting questions, and you brought up Plato. A lot of these questions go way back to at least classical times when those people were asking the great human questions too, right?
Before we go, and this has been a lot of fun, what do you want people to know? Because one of the things, we'll talk about the podcast, talk about the book, talk about Dan Carlin. As people leave tonight, what do you want people to know about you? What do you want people to know about Dan Carlin?
I'm sorry, it sounds like such a cliche. I started off with this too. There's no way to tell you guys how grateful I am. I mean, it's so silly to say, but when you when the life that I lead right now is directly related to the people listening to the podcast. And I remember when the business that I did before starting the podcast failed. I forgot what I was, probably 40 or something. And I remember looking, going, "What the heck am I going to do?" Right? Like we all do in life sometimes. What the heck am I going to do? And the fact that I did this, and that because of you folks, it's worked out, and it's provided my children with food on the table. I mean, gratitude and relief, and so I'm really thankful. So that's all, it really boils down to that. I mean, I know it sounds silly and cliched, but I'm, as a guy who likes history, right, so I can take three steps back and look at my own life. My life is what it is because these people listen to the show. So I'm very grateful, and thank you so much for showing up.
On that, we'll conclude. Thank you so much for joining us. Stan will be available to sign his books over here to your left.
Listen, please stay in touch with me, would you?
Hi there, I'm Gavin Crawford. I'm a writer, an actor, and a comedian. And for the last 8 or 9 years, I have been navigating life with my mother's increasing dementia. Has it been sad? Yeah. Has it been funny? Also, yeah. That's what my brand new podcast series, Let's Not Be Kidding, is about. It's the true story of my life as a comedian, my mom, and dementia. Let's Not Be Kidding, with me, Gavin Crawford. A new 7-part series from CBC Podcasts, available now.